We've all been asked to name our favorite movies. What if you had the responsibility of determining which movies to save for all time? That's what the National Film Registry has been doing since 1988, and its list is now up to 550 American films, which you can find out about in Daniel Egan's books, America's Film Legacy, published by Continuum. His first one covered the initial 500 choices, and his latest companion volume includes the 50 films that have been added to the list since then. Everything from well-known features like Airplane and The Empire Strikes Back to obscure ones like A Study in Reds or Hot Dogs for Gauguin. Daniel Egan writes the blog Real Culture for the Smithsonian, and it is my great pleasure to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
It's great to see you, Leonard.
So, Airplane, it was quite funny, but wouldn't some purists question whether it's a film for the ages?
I'm not sure that it's a film for the ages myself, but the issue is that how significant is it as a film? And this really introduced a new style of comedy to filmmakers, and I think that's the reason why it was included.
Empire Strikes Back has been included, as I said. But the list also includes a very early 1967 film by George Lucas, Electronic Labyrinth THX 1138:4EB. I've only known it as THX over the years. Is that a good film, or is that in there because of George Lucas?
It's there because it's a student film that George Lucas made, and it sort of predicts the type of film he would be making later in his career. He actually remade it as a feature with Robert Duvall.
Oh, that's the one I guess I've seen.
This is a shorter version with no-name cast that he shot on campus and in a computer room. And what's really interesting about it is seeing how he solved problems with having no sets and no budget and no costumes. But it still looks like a futuristic science fiction film.
So he did pretty well. You can see the talent to come.
Oh, sure. You can see exactly what he would be doing in the Star Wars films. And, you know, you mentioned Empire Strikes Back, and one of the reasons why that's included on the National Film Registry is because Lucas keeps changing it. He keeps adding digital effects. He keeps editing it. There are all these different versions. And I think the people at the registry are afraid that the actual original material might be lost. And since so much of the special effects were done on computers and computer programming, they're actually at risk of being lost. When they went to recreate some of the stuff from Indiana Jones, for example, they couldn't. They didn't have the technology anymore.
Well, many films have been edited and re-edited, and we keep on getting new versions. They find lost footage and such. So what does the National Film Registry come up with? Do they say the official version, as far as we're concerned, is the one that was released in 1958?
Well, yes, yeah, they say that. They say they want the original version. But then you look at somebody like Stanley Kubrick and for 2001, after he showed it one time in Washington, he cut 20 minutes out of it. And then by the time it was shown in New York, there was even more footage missing. So what is the definitive version? That's a good question.
And then sometimes the directors complain that their version was butchered by a studio.
You look at something like Blade Runner, there are 7 different versions of that film. And Ridley Scott is not happy with any single one of them.
Even though he's done a few of them. They say director's cut on the DVD.
Exactly. I think the problem is he can't figure out what the story actually is.
But it's a fabulous film. I hope that's in the registry.
Yes, it's in the earlier volume, yes.
Who are the filmmakers with the most numbers of films in the list?
I don't have an exact count right now, but I think after they added Mrs. Miniver and another Wyler film, I think he's up to 9. So I think William Wyler is the one who has the most films.
Which would mean he's the greatest director we've ever had.
He's the greatest one that they're collecting. I think that was what it means. No,
Because I would have thought John Ford, Howard Hawks, Alfred Hitchcock.
There are many more Hitchcock.
Wyler was wonderful, but is he in their league?
Oh, yes, definitely. A film like Dodsworth, or a film like Memphis Belle, a film like The Best Years of Our Lives. They're very definitely important films that should be there. He was the director who had more actresses win Oscars than any other director. He was the director who had more Oscar nominations than any other director. So, yes. But as far as John Ford goes, or Alfred Hitchcock, there are certainly several more films of theirs that are eligible, worthy of being added to the registry.
So it's just a matter of, it's like the Hall of Fame, the Baseball Hall of Fame. If you wait long enough, Rabbit Moranville will make it in.
Perhaps. Some people are never going to get in, though, I'm afraid.
Yeah, I'm really upset about Pee-wee Reese. Did you have to watch all of these films to research them for the book?
I was lucky enough to watch all these films.
Available from Netflix?
I think it's terrible to watch a film on Netflix. I hate to say it. It's horrible to watch a film on a computer or your iPad or whatever phone you're using.
They'll send you a disc.
Yes, they used to. They're going to change all of that. Netflix is getting out of DVD business. However, you really want to see these films projected onto a screen. It's a different experience when you see a film in a theater than watching it on TV. But however, there were some that I had to watch on DVD, yes.
Were there any that you were dreading that actually turned out to be better than you'd expected?
Well, you know, I hate horror films. I get very scared of them. So I was not looking forward to The Exorcist, and I was not looking forward to The Incredible Shrinking Man. But The Incredible Shrinking Man actually turned out to be a wonderful science fiction film. I'm going to be showing it at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in February. It's, I think, the most existential of science fiction films, and it's really, it takes you on a journey that most science fiction films never get to that area. Jack Arnold made it. Richard Matheson wrote the screenplay. He also wrote I Am Legend, which has been remade a number of times. It's Mr. Arnold, I forget. I'd have to look it up. You caught me on the spot there. But I'll know by February.
Well, there are a few mysteries that have to be cleared up. For example, John Huston's Let There Be Light was made in 1945, wasn't it? But 46, but it wasn't released until 1981. That's censored?
Right. Yes, it was censored. He was in the Army at the time, and he was making movies for the Army. He made a triptych of films, including Battle of the Aleutians and Battle of San Pietro, Trip to the Aleutians. And then this was going to be the Army asking him to make a film about what were called psychoneurotics at the time, basically soldiers who had shell shock. And one of the cameramen...
What we would call PTSD now.
Yes, exactly. One of the cameramen he had worked with in the Battle of San Pietro suffered from that and was sent to an Army facility in Brentwood, Long Island, where they treated the soldiers. And that's where John Huston went, and he followed... they brought in like 60 people a week, and they went through a long course. They had vocational therapy. They saw... underwent hypnosis, drug therapy, also shock therapy, and he filmed all of those things. And the idea was the Army wanted to show consumers, the Americans, that these soldiers were not actually raving lunatics, but they were fine. Unfortunately, when they saw the finished film, they realized that they really couldn't show this to people because it was so depressing.
Well, The Best Years of Our Lives is also about somebody who comes home with seriously damaged because of the war, but that has an upbeat ending and
a happy ending, yes.
And this was not happy in any way.
Well, this is saying these are damaged people and they're going to remain damaged the rest of their lives, which is not the message the Army wanted to send out.
So why 1981?
Huston was making a film called Annie, the musical, and his producer got together with Jack Valenti and they appealed to the vice president to get it released, and at that point there was nobody left to complain than say no.
Now, there are other films that seem really timely when they're released. How do they hold up a film like All the President's Men?
All the President's Men's made really very well, and it's a film that is strong acting and a strong story, and it really is something that should be seen today, I think, especially in the climate of the press and how it operates today. It's fascinating seeing how good reporters used to be.
My guest is Daniel Egan, who has added to his previous volume, America's Film Legacy, with a guide to the 50 landmark movies that were added by the National Film Registry in 2009-2010. I mentioned in the introduction that two of the films that were added were A Study in Reds and Hot Dogs for Gauguin, films I have never seen. Were they difficult to locate?
Hot Dogs for Gauguin is hard to see because if you go to NYU, you can see it because it was made by Martin Brest when he was a student there. It's a wonderful film. It's one of the best student films I've ever seen because it's not like a student film. Most other student films, the director is trying so hard to impress people with great camera work and great sets. And the story to Hot Dogs for Gauguin is so strong that really you could film it any way at all and it would still work. And that's pretty much what Martin Brest did.
Although he did have a really interesting, very young cast, a couple that went on to get married, or were they already married?
I'm not sure that they were married yet, but Danny DeVito and Rhea Perlman. But after this, they all went out to AFI. They all went out to Los Angeles, and Martin Brest and Danny DeVito both took courses at AFI for directing. So this was really a really important turning point in DeVito's career.
And what about A Study in Reds? How did you locate that? And what is it?
A Study in Reds is a wonderful home movie that was shot in Wisconsin by Miriam Bennett, whose father was one of the original landscape photographers out in that area. And this is an example of a home movie that the National Film Registry wants to highlight because they want to show all the different varieties of film that are available. Study in Reds is sort of a fantasy in which a book club, sort of falls asleep and wakes up in Soviet Russia, and it's how they imagine life in Russia would be, which is hard and very funny.
Accurate?
No, it's
Cold War movie.
Well, it was made in 1932, so it would be
pre-Cold War, but
pretty accurate. Everyone's starving to death and eating dirt and things like that.
Now, there's a good representation of Westerns. Roy Rogers Under Western Stars is included. Roy Rogers, I saw those movies when I was a kid. So what's next? A Gabby Hayes series?
I think Gabby's in one of them already. The thing about Roy Rogers is he built himself as the king of the cowboys, and he really was in a sense of having an empire of cowboy material, records, books, lunchboxes, guitars, horses, you name it. What I find interesting about Under Western Stars was that it wasn't actually his vehicle. It was for Gene Autry, but Gene Autry was having labor problems with Republic, and they slipped Roy into his role.
I'm assuming Gene Autry's already made it into the registry.
Gene's there with Melody Ranch, yes.
And the other Westerns, Once Upon a Time in the West, Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller, these are movies that many people consider among the best Westerns, and these are postmodern Westerns or post-Western Westerns.
Well, I would definitely say that about Once Upon a Time in the West, and it's surprising that it's in this collection because Sergio Leone was an Italian filmmaker and he shot most of it in Spain.
So this has to be American films?
Yes.
It is in English and it does feature a lot of American actors.
Well, he got financing from Paramount, so that's how they considered it to be an American film.
I understand the story behind a film called A Trip Down Market Street is really remarkable. This is a film that only lasts 13 minutes.
It's a silent film from 1906, I believe. And I saw it a couple of years ago for the first time, and it's a camera mounted on the top of the front of a cable car going down Market Street. And it's the full travelogue. And it has this sort of hypnotic beauty when you're seeing it because it's shot in 35 and it's really beautiful. But there is another element to it that you find out later that's sort of heartrending because it was filmed about 3 days before the earthquake in 1906. So everything you're seeing gets destroyed, and a lot of the people you're viewing in the film were probably killed in the earthquake.
Wow, that's horrifying. 25 films are added each year. Can people make suggestions?
Certainly. You're allowed to vote, and they encourage you voting. You go to the website, and you can put in whatever title you want.
Daniel Egan will be introducing the 6:45 screening tonight of King Vidor's The Big Parade at Film Forum, 209 West Houston Street. He'll also be signing copies of both of his books afterwards. And for ticket information, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. You can also find a link to his blog, Real Culture, R-E-E-L Culture, there as well. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. It's great being here.